You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Good afternoon. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom just this 1 hour. I'm Carl Frisch. You can find out more about me at carlfrisch.com. Follow me on Twitter at Carl Frisch. As I said, I'm just filling in for this first hour of the show. Tom will be back. He is currently helping to occupy the courts. He's on the steps of the Supreme Court for the second anniversary of the absolutely evil Citizens United decision. He'll be speaking at the U.S. Supreme Court, along with folks like David Cobb from Move to Amend, Dr. Jill Stein, who is the 2012 Green Party candidate for president, Annabelle Park from Coffee Party USA, and Medea Benjamin of Code Pink. You can join the action in your city. There's actions all over the country as we speak. Go to movetoamend.org/occupythecourts, and you can get details there. Tom will be back at the top of the next hour. But in the meantime, I am joined by Elizabeth Kucinich. She is the Director of Public Affairs for the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. Elizabeth, thanks for joining me.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
So let's just get right to it. I mean, one of the stories in terms of, or at least I wanted to chat with you about, the obesity epidemic in America. I mean, Mrs. Obama has really tried to make this an issue. And, of course, the right-wing media thinks that she's trying to turn it into a nanny state. And all she's trying to do is encourage healthier living.
Mm-hmm.
But, again, anytime the Obamas do anything, the right-wing media is going to attack. I mean, if he took his daughters ice skating on the mall this winter, they'd probably accuse him of trying to act like Jesus because he's walking on water. I'm interested to know what you think. I mean, the CDC is finding that we're as obese as ever, that we're stuck in this obesity epidemic no matter how much awareness there is. What can we do?
Well, I think that Mrs. Obama's done a great job in bringing that conversation to the public sphere. But we really need to take it further. This is not about a nanny state. This is really about informing people, educating people, and allowing them to make their own choices, but based upon knowing information.
Right.
And at the moment, you know, our physicians aren't taught about nutrition, and so how can the population really understand it and or be expected to understand it to any degree? So that's where I, at the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, are doing a lot of work. We work with tens of thousands of physicians, reaching out to them, teaching them about nutrition, and getting them on board to understand that, yes, you can diagnose people and give them medications, but you can also help them with their dietary choices.
And we'll get to a very famous case in just a second. But one of the things that strikes me, particularly in communities of color and in urban areas, is the lack of food choices. I mean,
yeah.
During the 60s Civil Rights Movement, when there were the riots in the late 60s and early 70s, a lot of grocery stores never reopened in urban areas. And the ones that did are giving second-rate produce, mm-hmm. Sometimes remainder produce from their better grocery stores. What can we do in urban areas to get this message even further out there? Because it's a problem when you're forced to buy your groceries at a liquor store or at a corner bodega that has, you know, second rate food products. It's no wonder that people choose unhealthy.
Absolutely. Well, because that is the choice. That's what they have. That's the only option. And so, you know, this is a big problem. This is where policy really needs to step in. One suggestion that has been made is really to look at what people can buy with food stamps. Because very often you find that these food deserts are in areas of prevalence where people are on food stamps. And you can buy pretty much any kinds of foods using those dollars. If we could say, okay, we want the food stamp program to actually be a nutrition program that makes sure that people get access to good food, how about we make it that you can use your food stamp dollars to purchase X, Y, and Z, like whole grains, fruits,
or
and vegetables.
Or even if the food stamp dollar was more valuable for buying those things. So if you bought whole grains and fruits and vegetables and things that are healthier for your family, a dollar was equal to $1.25 or $1.50.
There have been some pilot programs like that around the country which have been very successful. Yes, that would be wonderful, but I'm really thinking about how can you incentivize a store owner to actually stock the foods
right.
that people need to be buying and should have the opportunity of buying. And so if that food dollar goes, it can only be received by the store owner if they are stocking healthy foods, then that's a good incentive to that shopkeeper
Absolutely.
To
Especially
actually
now that,
stock them.
You know, now that there are actual cards that look like debit cards
yeah.
or whatever, so many places that you walk into nowadays have the little sign in the window saying that they take those cards.
Yep.
And then you look around the store and you're like, for what?
Exactly. You know, for a highly shelf-stable processed piece of, I don't know, that's been there for a year. That's
for a
not
box
what
of crackers that will outlive me.
Exactly.
It will never biodegrade.
Yeah.
So I'm interested in your take. I mean, one of the biggest stories as far as nutrition goes, and, you know, I do like a good southern dish from time to time. As it shows, if you're watching on Free Speech TV or on the internet. But this discussion over Paula Deen's health condition, and, you know, my thoughts go out to her, of course, and her family, and I don't want anybody to have to go through that. And one of the reasons that we're talking about nutrition is when you're only having access to these types of foods, a lot of people do get type 2 diabetes. And, you know, I'm not one of these people who believes that Paula Deen, the second she found out, should have been out there talking about it. I believe each person does it in their own time. But the reluctance to change the way that she cooks, the reluctance to, you know, she says that she preaches moderation. I've watched her show. When she makes something with 8 sticks of butter, she doesn't then say, like, and here's your portion size, or you should only eat this once a year. It's never, the only time she ever preaches moderation, it seems, is when somebody asks her, is this healthy? I'm interested to hear your take on the whole controversy.
Well, you know, everybody can live how they want to live. I want people to know that if they want to be able to reverse their type 2 diabetes or help them, their bodies from not actually bringing it on in the first place, that a whole grain, plant-based diet is the way to go. And Dr. Neil Barnard, who's the president of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, did an amazing amount of research that was NIH-funded into the reversal of type 2 diabetes using a vegan diet. And we got amazing results. And the difference with that is that if you stock your cupboards with all the foods that you can eat, it's really delicious foods, and there's so many out there that are plant-based, and you can eat as much of them as you want, that is so much better than having to weigh and measure and cut a small slice and feel deprived and, you
well,
know,
I mean,
feel just get depressed from
but
it.
But part of it is in America, at least, where our bodies are conditioned to really love fat and salt and sugar, right? So I know that that's reversible just by changing your diet, but it takes time for your body to stop being like, you need to go get a Big Mac and, you know,
and
cover it with sugar.
It's a food addiction, and
sure,
the companies who produce that kind of food have done wonders in mixing, you know, sugar and fat and salt, which are really quite addictive for us, in quantities that will make us
want
to crave.
How long did it take? I can't imagine that you were always vegan.
No.
But when you became vegan, how long did it take for your body to get used to it and enjoy it as much as, so that you didn't feel like you were being deprived?
Well, what's lovely now is that there's so many transition foods. So if you want that nice big juicy hamburger, you'd have a nice big juicy vegetable burger that looks, smells, and tastes like the hamburger, but it has no, you know, very little saturated fat and no cholesterol in it, and is very high in fiber, as opposed to something which is very high in saturated fat, very high in cholesterol, and has low fiber. So
it hurts the
and hurts everything. You know, right. We all know the story. So there's wonderful ways to transition across, and there's great things in lots of supermarkets now. And if you visit pcrm.org, then you can find out resources and ways to transition. We
That's
also have
great
Food for Life instructors in most communities to teach you how to cook.
We've been talking about nutrition. We've been talking about the importance of our own health and what we eat and what we put in, and the importance of making those types of choices available to a broader audience. We've been talking to Elizabeth Kucinich. She is the Director of Public Affairs at the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. And you can find them at pcrm.org. She's also on Twitter at EJ Kucinich. And you can follow the Physicians Committee at PCRM. Elizabeth, thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much.
All right. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom this hour and this hour alone, I'm Carl Frisch. And when we come back, we're going to be chatting with Jeff List about everything that's happening with Newt Gingrich in South Carolina. You won't want to miss it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Up next, my open marriage with Newt Gingrich. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch, and that is, of course, Etta James, who it was announced today passed away. So multi-Grammy Awards, multiple blues music awards. Etta James is dead, I believe, at 78. Her first album, At Last, is probably one of my favorite albums that's always in heavy rotation on my computer. I almost said CD player. I haven't used a CD in a very long time. But, you know, if you were watching television last night, our favorite reality show continued into its, I guess, second season, as it were. They're down to four, which means that approximately 85 Republican candidates have been voted off the island. But we're left with a surging Newt Gingrich, which I apologize for the choice of words, and Mitt Romney, and Rick Santorum, and Ron Paul. And, you know, I've got a great guest that I'm going to bring in just a second, but I was reading Twitter this morning, and apparently folks are saying that Newt Gingrich is going to pull this off, regardless of what the second Mrs. Gingrich has to say about him wanting an open marriage. And let's look at this for a second. Newt Gingrich wanted an open marriage, but he's against me even having a legal committed one that's recognized throughout the country. So, for what it's worth. Anyways, joining me now to talk about this and more, I'm joined by Jeff List. He is a partner at Anzalone List Research. It's a nationally recognized Democratic polling firm. Jeff, thanks for joining me. So, one thing that's become apparent is that the Republican base in this election is absolutely schizophrenic. They have no idea what they want. They just know that they don't want anything consistently from week to week. What are you seeing out there?
Well, they're pretty sure they don't want Romney, or at least there's a large percentage of them that are pretty sure of that. I mean, there has been a Republican candidate who has surged in the days before each of the three elections. I mean, it's Gingrich now. You know, you certainly saw Santorum in Iowa, and to some extent Huntsman in New Hampshire. I mean, there's been a non-Romney surge in each of these primaries. I mean, Romney has real problems with the Republican base, and I think that part of the reason for that is that the Republican base is you know, right of right.
Yeah, well, what's interesting to me is that Romney's been running right for quite a long time, and they just won't buy it. I mean, what do you... I'm interested, has anybody actually looked at his 25% that he always seems to pull at? Has anybody drilled into that and seen how many people actually support Romney versus how many people only support Romney because they think he's the only guy that can beat Obama?
Well, I think there's certainly some of that second. You know, Romney won Iowa among people whose top priority was beating Obama. But, you know, I also think that Romney is going to have a hard time, you know, running right. I mean, he certainly tried to become the Tea Party candidate in this election. And I think that, I mean, at this point, the thinking person's argument for voting for Romney is vote for Romney. He doesn't really believe any of that stuff he's saying right now. And that's, I mean, that's sort of the best that he can do at this point.
Well, it's interesting because Mitt Romney believing it. And what's fascinating is that he's only been attacked on things that would, until recently, the whole Bain Capital thing. All of the attacks on Romney have been issue-specific to the base. So he flip-flopped on choice. He flip-flopped on gay rights. He flip-flopped. He hired an illegal undocumented immigrant. His health care plan is the basis of Obamacare. That's stuff that would only play really well in a Republican primary, and that's only the tip of the iceberg when it comes to his flip-floppery. What do you think happens if he's the nominee? He's never been able to muster much beyond the 25 to 30% that he's getting in these primaries and in these polls. And then Democrats start talking about issues that are actually going to make the skin crawl for independents and any Democrat that would ever consider voting for a Republican.
Well, I think the fact that he's tried to run so hard right in the primaries is going to be a problem for him with independents in the general election. I mean, but I think that a bigger problem than the flip-flopping is who he's always been, you know, which is privileged and extraordinarily wealthy.
But his family didn't leave him any money. That's what he said last night in the debate, which I found remarkable when you consider that he's basically trying to say, I didn't end up with any advantages growing up. And your father ran for president, was a senator, was a governor, and you didn't have any advantages just because he didn't give you an inheritance?
Yeah, I mean, he grew up with more privilege than Louis XVI. I mean, it's ridiculous. But, I mean, beyond that, you've got somebody who really helps paint a stark picture of why the economy in this country has gone so far sideways. You know, he's worth $250 million. He pays less as a tax rate than most hardworking Americans. He's got millions of dollars stashed offshore in the Caymans. I mean, he's sort of emblematic of an economy in which very few have gotten ahead by playing a rigged game. in which the vast majority of Americans, if they show up at work every day and work as hard as they can, don't have the opportunity to get ahead and build wealth. And those hardworking Americans are being asked to bear the whole sacrifice, are being asked to bear the whole burden to balance the budget, whereas the wealthy and corporations aren't asked to pay their fair share.
Well, if we would just let our children clean toilets in our schools, I think we'd be far better off. I want to play a clip for you, and then we can talk about the man of the hour. Let's hit clip two.
I think the destructive, vicious, negative nature of much of the news media makes it harder to govern this country, harder to attract decent people to run for public office, and I am appalled that you would begin a presidential debate on a topic like that.
So, that's the big crybaby Newt Gingrich. I'm reminded of a former Time magazine cover of Newt Gingrich dressed like Baby New Year. So he's surging in South Carolina. Is he going to win?
I think there's a good chance that he's going to win. I think he had a very strong debate last night. I thought that, you know, going after the news media was just red meat for their
vintage
base.
Vintage Republican.
Standard Roger Ailes, you know, George H.W. Bush going after CBS. But, you know, it plays, and I think that it blunted what otherwise could have been a pretty rough news day for him at a time when Romney is really tripping over himself with the income tax rate and with the Cayman account.
In fairness, he's only had 5 years to prepare for an answer to that question. Jeff Liss, I want to thank you for joining me. He is a partner at Anzalone List Research. You can find them online at anzaloneresearch.com. You can follow them on Twitter at Anzalone List, and we'll be linking to that on tomhartman.com. Jeff, thanks for joining me.
Hey, girl. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom just this hour. Tom will be back at the top of the next hour. I am Carl Frisch, and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, we'll be talking to Families USA, which is where we are in Washington.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you live from the Family Health Action 2012 conference put on by Families USA. And just got back from the Supreme Court where there's a big hoopla going on there. And I gave about a 10-minute speech in front of the Supreme Court. We occupied the court. And the local Occupy movement from D.C. showed up. And this whole thing was put on and promoted by movetoamend.org. David Cobb is speaking. It's wild. So what's going on in D.C.? We'll get to that a little bit more. Thanks to Carl Frisch for filling in for me for the first half hour. Sitting with me right now is Kim Bailey. Kim Bailey is the research director at Families USA. Families USA, of course, putting on this conference, Health Action 2012. Kim, welcome.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. Tell us about what the issues are. You're the research director, so you're digging into, I'm assuming, the entrails of to use a butcher metaphors are awful, aren't they, in medicine? But, you know, into the guts of what's going on with healthcare in the United States. What are you learning?
Well, that's right. I'm the doom and gloom person sometimes, I think, of myself when I quantify the problems that we have, because we have a lot of them in our healthcare system.
Yeah.
And we have a lot of uninsured people. We have a lot of underinsured people. Yeah. And we have a real cost problem as well.
So what do we do about it? You know, we're not going to have single payer tomorrow morning. So, but we're moving. Obamacare seems to be, and I use that affectionately. I realize it's supposed to be a slur, but I think
embrace it.
Yeah, yeah,
there you
that's
go,
what
yeah.
I, you know, I'm all about that. What has it done so far? Why don't most people know about the benefits so far? I mean, how could it be that last night, you know, a thousand people in South Carolina applauded every time, you know, somebody said, the first thing I do when I become president is I'm going to get rid of Obamacare. What don't they know?
They don't know what's in the law. When you talk about the provisions that are in the Affordable Care Act or in Obamacare, as we affectionately call it, people like it. People like that pre-existing condition exclusions will no longer be allowed. People like that insurance companies are going to be held accountable for how dollars are spent. People like that they're going to get help paying for premiums and that out-of-pocket protections are going to be provided. So when you break down the law bit by bit, people like it. But what they are afraid of is change. And there's been a lot of messaging from opponents of reform that has been really effective. So my job as a research director at Families USA is breaking down the law bit by bit and explaining what the problems are currently and how the law will help to solve them.
Yeah, well, I think you've done a good job of just going through them right there and then. The one that I didn't hear is the 80%, or did you cover that? In
well, that's another good one, the 80-20 rule, as we like to call it. Yeah.
So why don't you explain that to our viewers?
We need to ensure that insurers are held accountable for how premium dollars are spent. And right, you know, prior to reform, insurers could retain as much as they wanted to in profits and overhead.
And did. Bill McGuire took $1.7 billion in personal income in his 10 years as CEO of United Healthcare.
It was quite astronomical and very shocking. But what the 80-20 rule does is say that in the small and individual markets, insurers have to spend at least 80% of each dollar collected in premiums actually delivering care. And that means they can save 20% for other things, which, you know, I think is still, there's still some room there. That's a lot of profits and overhead in and of itself. And in large markets, it's actually a little bit better. Yeah. They have to spend 85% delivering care.
Yeah, well, that's great because Medicare operates on an overhead. I mean, that's what we're saying is that they can take 20% and pay themselves million-dollar salaries and have private jets with gold-plated bathrooms and things. They can still do that because Medicare delivers and VA delivers health care
with
what kind of overhead?
Single digits, 4-ish percent.
4%.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's the real cost. And so, therefore, presumably, Canada, all the other European countries, South American countries, Central American countries that are offering health care to all, China has now announced they're doing a healthcare for all program. They're rolling it out across their country. Other countries that are doing this, they have to be operating. None of them are given 20% to their corporate fat cats, are they?
No, they're not. And there are a lot of efficiencies to be gained in the U.S. system. I think that's, you know, on one hand, we have a real healthcare cost problem. On the other hand, we have a great opportunity. There's a lot of room for improvement. And I think, you know, what the Affordable Care Act does is provide some real frameworks for making sure that we are getting value for each of the dollars that we invest in our healthcare system.
Very well said. Kim Bailey, the research director of Families USA. Kim, thanks so much for being with us today. I really appreciate you dropping by.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much. Let's pick up a couple of your calls. Kim is doing just absolutely great work. And the website, of course, familiesusa.org for more information. Wanted to pick up a couple of your calls here since I just finished. And, in fact, tell you what happened. I was over at the Supreme Court just a few minutes ago. And there was this a group that sang songs about corporations, and there was this guy dressed like a billionaire with $1,000 bills flowing out of his pocket, and I mean, it was real theater. It was extraordinary. We're going to have some video of it up on YouTube, and you can see it on our website at tomhartman.com, and you know some of our radio stations I know pull some of our video off youtube.com/tomhartman, and you might find it on their homepages and whatnot. So anyhow, we will be sharing that with you, and we'll get some audio clips as time goes on. But basically my rant was the Supreme Court, by giving freedom to corporations, took it away from us and left us with the freedom to die like a dog in the street if you don't have health care, left off with us with the, you know, the freedom to have your small business trampled by a giant corporation, left us with, you know, this whole series of basically negative freedoms, destructive freedoms. Michael in Dublin, Virginia. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind today?
Hey, how you doing, Tom? I hope your studio gets back up to par when you get there, and we can get the vision looking good again.
Hold on just a second. Jacob, would you say that back to me again?
Okay.
Oh, okay.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, Tom. I'd like to talk about the Republican candidates. What I see in Republican candidates is that they're simply the same thing that we've always been given. We have Mitt Romney, who is obviously corporate owned, which I don't take anything away from him. We have Newt Gingrich, who appears to be very confused, and we have Ron Paul, who's making a statement that nobody else is really touching points on. And Rick Santorum, who knows where he stands. But I'll tell you this, corporations and politics, they all have a play in functioning together in America. We have to have corporations. That's how we have the things we have.
Yeah, but they don't have to have they don't have to be people.
But yes, that's right. They already have people. And that's us. They need us, and we need them. Now, you see what I'm saying here?
Yeah, although I'm not convinced that we even need corporations. I'm not advocating that we destroy them. But the reality is that there are other models. For example, a model where all the workers, you know, the cooperative movement, where all the people who work in the organization also own the organization. And that's very different than the corporate form. There are a lot of ways that organizations can be put together. But, Michael, your point is well made. Thank you very much for calling and making it. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Oh, I have several things I wanted to
please
talk
pick
about.
One.
Okay, well, you know, Newt Gingrich, it just really wrangled me that, well, first of all, that, you know, it shows by what he has done in his personal life that he has very little character. And I think you could say that if he's going to treat his wives so badly over the years, what is he going to do to us when he becomes president? Because in a sense, the president is married to the people.
Yes.
And I wanted to be able to, you know, just, you know, run that by you. And, you know, it just amazes me that, quote, South Carolina is a very Christian and moral state, frankly, and yet, you know, they don't have any problem with that. That is, there's a big, big disconnect between acts. Work.
Yeah. Well, actually, I think they do have a problem with it. And one of the interesting things is, I mean, these are the people who, when Bill Clinton was being impeached, were saying if a man is lying to his wife, you can't expect him not to lie to the people. And now, obviously, Newt Gingrich has lied to multiple wives, and now they're saying we believe in redemption. And I think one of the things that's going on is that much of the Republican base is a very fundamentalist strain of Protestant Christianity. That believes, and perhaps some Catholic Christianity in general, that believes that it's possible to have, you know, not just all your sins wiped clean in the eyes of God, but also that you can be reinvented as a person through the act of religious conversion.
Can I make one comment about that? One more comment?
Yeah.
Hello? Yeah. You know, I'm an Orthodox Christian. I don't think you can be any more fundamentalist than that. And the problem is their theology is incredibly wrong in the sense that, you know, you do not have assurance of salvation because, say, I ask for forgiveness. It has to actually be worked out within your heart. And any true Christian, no matter whether they're of my denomination or other denominations, realizes that there is a process that goes on within a person's heart, and he has not worked through that, and he continues on, you know, sinning.
Well, you don't know what's in Newt Gingrich's heart.
And I can't vote for somebody that is, you know, in his own words, he is.
Yeah. I'm frankly, Newt Gingrich, you know, obviously is a little weird in his personal life. I mean, he married his high school teacher, right? I mean, his first wife. He's a little weird in his personal life. But frankly, I don't think that in and of itself necessarily translates to his being weird on policy. But the fact of the matter is that he is weird on policy, and that's why he scares me. So, anyway, we'll be right back. Tom Hartman here with you, live from Washington, D.C.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We're live at the Families USA Health Action 2012 conference. More of your calls and thoughts and more guests from the Health Action Group coming up. Stick around.
Wake up.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you in Washington, D.C. And Ethan Rome is sitting across from me. He's the Executive Director of Healthcare for America Now, healthcareforamericanow.org, by coincidence, the website. And Ethan, tell us about Healthcare for America Now.
We are the nation's leading grassroots consumer organization on health care issues, fighting for quality and affordable health care and a fair democracy and a better America.
And what does that mean? Those are nice slogans, but what does it mean?
It means fighting to protect and promote the Affordable Care Act. It means defending Medicare and Medicaid from the Republican assault, and it means going after people like the billionaire Koch brothers who were trying to steal our democracy.
Wow. And how are you doing that?
We're doing that by organizing at the grassroots. We're doing that through doing events and demonstrations. Yesterday we were at the Supreme Court calling it the U.S. Supreme Koch.
I just came from there.
And with a huge banner, just to make sure that people understand that when the Supreme Court says that money is speech and that corporations can spend unlimited amounts of money because they're people, that's the way in which they steal our democracy.
Yeah, and they have been for some time, actually. The Citizens United arguably just codified it, nailed it down finally. But it's been a long time coming. It was back in 1886 when they first started talking about this stuff.
Yes, it was not a new idea, the ruining of our democracy. These guys just take it a step further.
Yeah, and then Lewis Powell in 73, saying to the Chamber of Commerce, hey, we got to take over this courts, we got to take over the colleges, we got to take over, And they've done it. It's absolutely astounding. And the healthcare system. I'm assuming healthcareforamericanow.org that, one of the things that you're about is probably a single payer system, a national single payer system, or state by state single payer system.
We are about right now promoting and defending the Affordable Care Act, which provides enormous.
Step one.
Which is absolutely a step one, provides coverage for 38 million Americans and also improves healthcare for the rest of us by going after the worst insurance company abuses. And that's one of the most important things that this law does, is it goes after the insurance companies in a way that no law ever has.
Yeah. T.R. Reid did that documentary. It was called Health Around the World, I believe, for PBS. It was a two-hour special, and he wrote a book of the same title. And one of the things that he identified is that of all the fully developed nations, the OECD, the 34 OECD nations, Organization of Economic and Cooperation and Development, we are the only one that doesn't make it a crime that you could be put in prison for to own or run a for-profit health insurance company that offers basic health care. It is illegal in every other country to do what is the core foundation of our health care system, which is, run a so-called health insurance company that's really just a giant banking scam where you skim 20%. Now legally you're limited to 20%, but they used to skim 30-40% off the top. That system is being reined in and substantially, and I think in a fairly healthy way, substantially regulated by Obamacare. But don't we ultimately at some point have to say, as the rest of the world has said, if we're going to have independent companies like Switzerland, they don't have a national health care system, but they do not allow for-profit health insurance companies. They're all not-for-profit. So there's no fat CEOs and there's no dividends to stockholders. Don't we have to move in that direction, ultimately?
I mean, I think the first step is doing exactly what we're doing now, which is using government to regulate insurance companies to put some control on their rapacious quest for profits, which they do without any regard to the rest of us. Because you nailed it when you talk about the way that they operate. They're not about selling insurance or providing health care. America's health care companies are about making money for their shareholders on Wall Street, and they don't care about health care. This law is about changing that. It's about putting them in check and making sure that we all get quality, affordable health care. And that's the first step. And there's no question, when you compare us to other countries, we vote less, we have less health care, we got lots of problems that we shouldn't have, given that we are the wealthiest country in the world.
Yeah, and it seems that a big piece of fixing that, I mean, if we're all about fixing that, that a big piece of fixing that is to get people off their butts and out into the streets, literally and metaphorically, get them on radio and television, get them writing letters to the editor, get them calling on their members of Congress, getting them politically active, getting them inside the political parties, for the people to take back this country.
That's what the 2012 election is about. I mean, for the Republicans, they have been running an assault on everything that is near and dear to all of us, on the basis of the middle class. And they're going after our rights to form unions. They're going after our right to vote, right? Voter suppression is their
literally
new favorite pastime. If we can stop regular folk from voting, then we don't have to worry about regular folk having a voice. And so that's why this 2012 election is so important, because it is truly about all of us against the credit card companies, the big banks, Wall Street, big oil, and we've got to win.
Yeah. But on the other hand, or not on the other hand, maybe to extend that, to simply say, yeah, go Democrats, I'm going to vote that particular way, or Greens or whatever, that's nowhere near enough. We have to infiltrate these political parties, take them over, change, you know, kick out the old corporocrats, and make it work. We've got even our and this is where the Supreme Court, you guys were there yesterday, I was there today. This is where the Supreme Court has been standing in the way with these right wing judges that, you know, Alito and Roberts on Citizens United. When Citizens United was decided, Sandra Day O'Connor was horrified, and she was a Republican conservative on the court. I mean, where do we go from? Are you working at all on that, on the issue of repealing Citizens United?
I mean, what we're
as a dimension of your healthcare work.
I mean, what we're doing right now is trying to expose the corrosive role that money plays in our politics. If you take the Koch brothers, for example, the billionaire Koch brothers, they're going to spend several hundred million dollars on these elections to buy the elections. They're going to do so through front organizations like Americans for Prosperity. So one of the things that we're doing is working to expose Americans for Prosperity all over the country. These guys are now opening up field offices, which they have not done before, right? They're kind of geared up for 2012. And that's why we need to get folks out in a big way. And you're right about the Democrats, for example. We need to ask the Democrats and demand that they stand up for more and that they stand up straight. And when the Republicans try to pick a fight with us, they fight back and win.
Yeah.
Because there's just too much at stake for people trying to confuse who they are.
Yeah, and I think probably one of the most effective ways to do that is to show up and say, hey, I'll be a precinct committee person. In other words, take over the party. Step into those slots. But in any case, we've wandered a bit off. Ethan Rome, the Executive Director, Healthcare for America Now, healthcareforamericanow.org. Thank you, Ethan.
Thanks very much.
Great having you with us. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Here's the opening question from last night's, I don't know how they call these things debates. Why don't they call it the Republican Circus? Here's the opening comment. The first question, clip one, Jake.
As you know, your ex-wife gave an interview to ABC News. In it, she says that you came to her in 1999, at a time when you were having an affair. She says you asked her, sir, to enter into an open marriage. Would you like to take some time to respond to that?
No, but I will.
And then clip number two, this is where Newt played the card that conservatives have been playing forever, it seems, that the media, which actually reports on what they're up to, must be nasty because they're reporting on what they're up to.
I think the destructive, vicious, negative nature of much of the news media makes it harder to govern this country, harder to attract decent people to run for public office, and I am appalled that you would begin a presidential debate on a topic like that.
Now, this from the guy who wanted to impeach Bill Clinton for having an affair, shall we say. The level of hypocrisy is astounding. It's astounding. Anyway, let's go beyond that for a moment. Carrie in Pipe Creek, Texas. Hey, Carrie, what's on your mind today?
How you doing?
Great. What's up?
I was just wondering, I've seen so many negative things in terms of race relations, the comments that were made by Gingrich and other Republican nominees.
Yeah, all the dog whistle stuff.
It's unbelievable. I was just wondering, do you have any information about how that, or a poll about the percentage of the electorate in the United States that is projected to be affected by that type of rhetoric?
Well, the fact that the Republicans that right now in the national polls, Mitt Romney and Barack Obama are neck and neck, tells me that a significant percentage of that Mitt Romney or the Republican base is affected by that kind of stuff, that racism is alive and well. I think probably the racist vote, as it were, in the United States is certainly not as big as it was 20, 30, 40 years ago, but it's still significant. If I had to just pull a percentage out of the air, I'd say it's probably 10, but I don't know. Go ahead.
Yeah, when you look at the news coverage by Fox and other right-wing sites, you wouldn't even know that.
Yeah, yeah. No, they go ahead.
It's like hysteria.
Yeah. No. Absolutely. And they promulgate these horrible stereotypes and Newt Gingrich and his whole food stamps and all this everything. You know, food stamp president which is code for, you know, oh my God, there's a black guy in the White House, et cetera, et cetera. You're absolutely right, Kerry. Kerry, thank you for the call and thanks for participating in the show. Jim in Harrisville, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hey, I'd really like to know if you would ever consider running for president.
No.
I mean, I love your show.
Thank you for the show.
You're like the most insightful man on TV.
It may be, but and I'm sure there's others who would debate that. But nonetheless, what I do well is write books and do radio and TV, and I'm having a lot of fun doing it. I forget which poet it was who said, you know, if you love your work, you never work a day in your life. The stuff that you have to do to become president of the United States requires a particular type of personality that I don't have. You have to be a genuine extrovert, and I'm actually an introvert who knows how to pretend he's an extrovert, when I'm on the radio or TV, but I'm really a very quiet and private person, and it isn't me. So, thank you for the implied compliment. It's appreciated, Jim, and hopefully by doing what I do well, we can have people who do what they do well in the political arena out there. So thank you very much for the call, and thanks for your kind words. Joan in Ludington, Michigan. Hey, Joan, what's up?
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment about Newty.
Mm-hmm.
If that man would treat his second wife a little better, for example, give her a little more than $20,000 a year in alimony, he might not be hearing about his private conversations on the evening news.
Is that how much he's giving her, $20,000 a year in alimony?
That's what I heard, and he's giving $81,000 to charity.
And $81,000, that's amazing. That's amazing.
Yep. And they said the $81,000 worked out to 2.5% of his income. So what's he giving his wife? Do the math.
Yeah, a little less than 1%. That's amazing. That's amazing. Joan, thank you for the call. I didn't know the details of that. Louise was just nodding and confirming it. Apparently it's out on the websites that I haven't had an opportunity to read yet this morning because I had to go over to the Supreme Court and occupy the Supreme Court, which was great fun, by the way. Excuse me. One of the problems of doing a remote is you don't have a sneeze button. And it was cold out there at the Supreme Court, I'm telling you. John in Los Angeles. Hey, John, thanks for listening to K-Talk. What's up? Anything goes Friday here.
Tom, Gesundheit. I was going to ask you if you're getting better.
I am getting better. I'm just...
Anyway, I had a couple questions. I'll make it quick. And by the way, James Dobson asked his people if they would want the First Lady, Newt's wife, to have been a mistress for 8 years.
Right. And what did they say?
Yeah. Nothing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, so that would shut Newt up too, I imagine. But anyway, two questions about that healthcare thing. You mentioned that in that European country you're at, it's illegal to be an insurer for healthcare?
In all of the OECD nations, the 34 most developed and industrialized countries in the world, we're part of that club, as it were. In the other 33 nations, it is legal to provide for-profit health insurance as secondary insurance. In other words, there are insurance companies in many of those countries that say, you know, if you want to have five-star meals catered to your hotel room, or if you want to have a special kind of doctor or whatever, or you want an extra policy that covers plastic surgery, they'll sell you those policies, and they'll do it at a profit. But primary care, you know, see a primary care doctor, take care of real diseases and stuff like that, in every one of those countries, offering that kind of health insurance on a for-profit basis is a crime. It's illegal.
Well, because of that fact, my question was sort of twofold. Is it also a crime, or if a for-profit health care provider such as a convalescent home existed? And maybe the other question was, is it a crime for a non-profit to operate and deal with for-profit vendors? And doesn't that make the nonprofit just as money conscious as a for-profit?
Well, and increasingly in the United States, some nonprofits are basically running like for-profits, and in some cases competing with for-profits, and using their nonprofit status as a way to pull off that competition. And all of that is like nasty stuff. How it's done in other countries, in individual countries, it really radically varies from country to country. Sweden, Switzerland, for example, has nothing but nonprofit insurance companies. But they're highly regulated, and they genuinely are nonprofit, and nobody is making a fortune off healthcare in that country. On the other hand, you have other countries that have single-payer healthcare systems. You have other countries that have kind of hybrid systems. So, but the point, John, and thank you for the call. I think the main point is that what we do in the United States isn't done in those other countries. It isn't legal in those other countries because they consider healthcare to be a right and not a privilege. So you can make a profit on things that are privileges, but if it's something that's a right, that's part of the commons, and that has to be done either nonprofit or done by government.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Back with more on Anything Goes Friday, live from Health Action 2012 in Washington, D.C. Anything Goes Friday, but we're also here at Health Action 2012, broadcasting our show live from this program put on by Families USA. And sitting with me is one of my personal heroes, one of the guys who's out there really doing the work, really doing the hard work and making things happen, Bob Edgar. He's the president and CEO of Common Cause, commoncause.org, the website. And Bob, what are you up to these days?
Well, Thomas, first let me just say it's great to be on your show, and we really appreciate what you've been doing over the last couple years to try to unfold the impact of Citizens United, which comes up on its anniversary tomorrow.
I gave a speech in front of the Supreme Court today.
Right. Well, as you know, 2 years ago, the Supreme Court, by a very narrow decision, 5-4, gave corporations and labor unions, but particularly corporations and the wealthy, the ability to dip into their corporate treasuries, spend that on independent expenditures, either supporting or trashing candidates. And we think that this year, this presidential year, will be the most corrosive year where money is going to taint the political system.
If the Republican primary so far is any indication.
Exactly.
That's certainly the case.
So this week, with the help of Robert Reich, who is our new chair of our board. And
oh, really? And he is such a good man.
He is. On our website, which we just launched this week, called www.amend2012.org, Bob does a two-minute show-and-tell with chalkboard kinds of things. This brand-new two-minute video is driving people to a website which gives them opportunity to find ways to amend the Constitution. But the unique thing about what Common Cause is doing, we're not fussing with the language of a constitutional amendment. We think there ought to be three principles of any language. One is to push back on the issue of money as speech. Right. Second is to push back on the issue that corporations are people.
Right.
And the third is to suggest that Congress and state legislative bodies be permitted to control and limit money in politics. Those three principles, we don't care exactly about all the language yet. We want people across the country, as they did in Los Angeles, as they did in New York City, as they're doing in towns and communities, let's pass some resolutions. Let's try to bind the House and Senate members to come back to Washington and work for a constitutional amendment. Yeah. But let's do it from the bottom up. To use a popular term, let's occupy democracy.
There you go. That's absolutely brilliant, Bob Edgar. And you're so right. I mean, money is not speech. It is property. Money is property. Mm-hmm. And corporations are obviously not people. Citizens United decision is the mirror image of Dred Scott. You know, Dred Scott, in 1856, the Supreme Court ruled that certain people are property.
Right.
And in 2012, the Supreme Court ruled that certain property is people. And they're both cases are plain old, flat-out nuts and right. need to be overturned.
Well, my staff doesn't like me to use this on the public airways, but my wife, who's a registered nurse, retired and operating room nurse, she says she'll believe corporations are people the day after they have a colonoscopy.
I keep hearing these, you know, the day after Texas one, executes right. one. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me we need corporations. We need corporations for a variety of reasons. But I think this is a time where we ought to fine-tune capitalism, not be afraid of it. There's, up till recently, there's been kind of a McCarthyism. Anybody who critiques capitalism is a bad person. But why should we have an economic system based on having a percentage of our people unemployed and a percentage of the world's population enslaved or under really serious economic disadvantage? We need to fine-tune our economic system, and we need to make sure that our elected officials aren't bought and paid for by large corporations. I mean, we called out the Koch brothers last year, David and Charles Koch, who are libertarians with a combined net worth of about $44 billion. They've used those billions of dollars to, in a sense, buy congressmen. They've got 12 members of the Energy and Commerce Committee who signed a pledge that they won't support any regulation of clean air and clean water. That's an outrage.
Wow.
And we've got to figure out some strategies to get young people to step forward and run for public office, and once elected, not have to spend their whole legislative time raising money. The freshmen of the Democrats and Republicans in the last 4 years have been told by their leadership they should spend 20 hours a week raising money for their reelection.
Right.
I want them to spend full time talking, working, collaborating, lowering the rhetoric in a point where they can sit and find each other as people rather than think of each other as partisan. When I served in Congress, some of my best friends were people like Dick Schweiker and John Hines, both Republicans from Pennsylvania, senators, Jake Javits, Senator Brooks. There was collegiality,
yes.
And we differed by ideology on the spectrum of liberal to conservative and all the moderates in the middle. But even those of us who fought like cats and dogs would have dinner together and liked each other as people, and the rhetoric was not the harsh rhetoric that we've seen since 1994.
Well, and in part because you had the time to participate with each other, because fundraising wasn't so much a part of it. I mean, this is something that really, you know, when Reagan came into office, I think there was only a couple hundred registered lobbyists in this town. Now there's tens of thousands, if my recollection is correct. There's been a sea change. There's been this radical sea change since the Powell memo, basically, and we've got to push back on it.
Yeah, several years ago when the Democrats took back the House of Representatives, the morning of the take back, John Dingell and a Democratic congressman from West Virginia had a breakfast, invited all the freshman members, invited all the lobbyists. The lobbyists came with stacks of money, stacks of not cash, but checks to give to those freshman members that they had not supported during the campaign.
Wow.
Republicans, when they took over just a year ago, they did it even better. They had a night before, a big gala, where they invited all the lobbyists to come meet all the freshman members, and the lobbyists brought their checks. And so when we served in Congress, or when I served in Congress, the talking points came first. After a year of looking at how you voted, then
maybe they would support.
They would support through political action committees that were fully transparent.
Yeah.
Now what's happened is the money comes first, that gets you in the door, and then they don't even care about the talking points. They just want to make sure you vote according to their...
or even take their legislation that they wrote. Bob Edgar, commoncause.org, the website. Check it out. Bob, thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We'll be back in just a moment with more here on Anything Goes Friday on the Tom Hartman Program, live from Health Action 2012, put on by Families USA.
You spend millions on elections like a real person. Citizens United, corporate person.
corporate personhood. Isn't it a wonderful thing? It certainly has been a good thing for Mitt Romney. He's one of the 15 percenters. He's in the 1%, and he pays a maximum income tax rate of 15%, which is, of course, what most of the people in the top 1% pay, or at least the top 1/10 of 1%, or in the case of Mitt Romney, the top 1/100 of 1%. They pay a maximum income tax rate of 15% because we have this special tax rate for capitalists, the capitalist gains tax in the United States, rather than so-called ordinary income. So he's come out, and they're people are saying, hey, what's the deal here? In fact, Nikki Haley, somebody asked her about it. Here's a tax issue, 15% tax, money in the Cayman Islands, doesn't file his tax returns. None of that looks convincing to ordinary Americans who are afraid of losing their jobs. Nikki Haley says, that's not true. It's not that he's never filed his tax returns. He's disclosed everything. He's filed every tax return. Fry says, they don't publish them. Haley says, he's going to do it in April. They say, why not now? Why would he have to do it now, says Nikki Haley. She's the Republican governor of South Carolina. She says, what he's talking about are the things South Carolina cares about, jobs, spending, the economy. Well, yeah. I think this is going to bite him in the butt. On the other hand, Tony Perkins, the Family Research Council's Tony Perkins, appeared on MSNBC this morning to discuss the debate last night. This is a guy who regularly condemns gay people and adulterers and all this stuff. And he says, people don't want to be seen as judgmental about Newt Gingrich. Right. We're not going to be judgmental. Let's not judge Newt. What am I missing here? Other than, you know, common sense and sanity, maybe? Could be. it's pretty impressive. Hart in Kennesaw, Georgia. Hey, Hart, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I really enjoyed your reference to the Supreme Court as the Supreme Coke. And it's often occurred to me that, or I've often thought that the use of humor and satire, and especially short, succinct, satirical references like that, can really capture truth and even sort of make people think and be educational in that sense. I was introduced to another one like that. It takes a little bit of explanation, but I think it's really, really powerful. You know, to those of us who are really, really upset by the gross indifference of the 1% to the real suffering of the other, of much of the other 99%, here's a little parable. We're all familiar with the fact that, or we've all heard, maybe it's a myth, that Nero fiddled while Rome burned, but it turned out he did much more than that. He had a huge, huge party, and everyone who was anybody was invited to the party. Mm-hmm. And in those days, there's a certain lighting problem that was produced by that many people in one place. So Nero solved the problem. Supposedly, according to Tacitus, the historian, he solved the problem by incinerating, burning at the stake, hundreds of criminals from the jails of Rome. And this story was told by an Indian journalist who was outraged at the indifference of the Indian rich and the Indian governing class to the massive suicides in India due to the agrarian policies partly imposed on them by the U.S.-dominated WTO. And he asks the question at the end of a speech that he gives in which he tells this story. He says, what kind of people could be Nero's guests at such an event?
Yeah.
And then the obvious question then arises: what kind of people in India would be Nero's guests?
Well, and let me also, an excellent point, Hart, and thank you for calling and making it. Let me add to that: what kind of people could be the guests at a Republican debate who would applaud somebody dying in the street because they don't have health insurance? Who would applaud trashing unemployed people who just want food stamps? Or an extension of their unemployment benefits. What kind of people? You know, to use your Nero example, I think it's a brilliant one. Very, very well done. Greg in Indianapolis, Indiana. Hey, Greg, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, Tom, with your Michigan background and good awareness of history, it came up again in the debate last night about how George Romney, Mitt's father, reported his tax returns for 12 years.
Yeah.
But I've also been hearing numerous times how George Romney came to America at age 5 from Mexico.
Yes.
They even talk about, and is it not one of our laws that you have to be born in the United States to run for the United for the presidency? So how could, was it George Romney able to run for the presidency in 1968 if he did not come to this country till age 5?
Well, somebody, yesterday somebody called and asked that question, and I said, I honestly don't know the answer to that question, and I'm still not sure I do. I did get a number of correspondences from people saying, you know, under the laws of citizenship, his father and mother were both U.S. citizens, but then I've also heard stories that it wasn't Mitt's grandfather, but great-grandfather who first went to Mexico so he could practice polygamy. But it's possible that his grandfather was born in the United States and then went back to Mexico. I just don't know the details of it, sir. So Greg. I can't comment. But it's something that I intend to educate myself about over the weekend here when I've got some time.
Okay, I appreciate that because I thought you had to be born in the United States or in the example of McCain, it was Panama Canal Zone.
Well, you have to be what the Constitution sets a slightly higher bar for the president than for any elected official, and rather than simply being a citizen, you have to be a natural born citizen,
right.
Which means that, you know, born of two parents who are American citizens anywhere in the world, I believe, or born here on American soil. And
okay, maybe I'm wrong. I thought you had to be born on American soil.
No, you can. You know,
No.
In fact, as everybody pointed out, John McCain was born in Panama. You could say that Air Force Base was American soil, but that's not the argument that they made. The argument that they made was that both of his parents were U.S. citizens. But you know, I'm not an expert on the details of that. Let me dig up on it. We'll talk on it next week. Thanks a lot for the call, Greg. Good to hear from you. Mike in New York City, watching on Manhattan Neighborhood Network. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Great.
I got a question for you about Mitt Romney. Anyway, while we're on that topic,
mm-hmm.
It was reported before the truth came out that Mitt Romney had won the Iowa, the Iowa vote, and they were saying then that all he had to really do was win South Carolina, and the rest of them could just about wrap it up. Now we find out that Rick Santorum won Iowa, and technically Mitt Romney has won nothing. So if he loses South Carolina, shouldn't he do the same and just step out?
I suppose. But it ain't going to happen. I mean, I get, you know, it's a rhetorical question and a good point. And I think that probably a lot of Republicans are right now scratching their heads about this kind of thing and saying, you know, what's the deal here? But the reality is that Mitt Romney is going to be the Republican presidential nominee. He's got offices in all the states. He's on all the ballots. Newt Gingrich isn't even on the ballot in a lot of states. He has no ground game. Newt Gingrich was running, as was Herman Cain, was running a book tour. A very profitable
right.
book tour to raise his profile, to up the fees he got for being on Fox, to sell more books and movies, to make money, and under the guise of a presidential campaign, and it has accidentally become a presidential campaign. And I think that the only people who seriously thought they were running for president, and maybe Ron Paul, you know, maybe thinking that he's laying the groundwork for a libertarian run or something like that, or just he's a true believer. But I think the only people who seriously thought they were running for president were Mitt Romney and maybe Rick Santorum, although he doesn't have much of a national apparatus
what?
Either. And with Michelle
Romney
Bachmann, she was just trying to raise money.
And by the presidency, he'll do it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And he has the ability. Mike, thanks a lot for the call. And with Michelle Bachmann, I mean, her race for the House of Representatives last year, or a year and a half ago, was the most expensive race in the United States. So she had to raise a lot of money, so she pretended to run for president, and that was a great way to raise money for her. Tim in Chevy Chase, Maryland. Got a minute of the break. Tim, what's up?
Real quick, and bear with me. You just went over the situation regarding replacing Kennedy's seat up in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
And I just want your take on whether there strategically is any link to Mitt Romney at this point holding off disclosing his tax situation because it would rile the populace, and I forget her name off the top of my head.
Elizabeth Warren, you're talking about?
Yeah, Elizabeth Warren. Strategically, if I was a Republican, I wouldn't want him to disclose anything at this point because of the emotional impact it would have in impacting that election. And
yeah.
So I'm wondering your take on whether that is a sound thought or what's your take would be on that.
It's a possibility. Thanks. I think the biggest reason why Mitt Romney doesn't want to release his returns is because he's a multi-millionaire. This is a guy who's worth hundreds of millions of dollars, and he's continuing to make millions of dollars. Literally in the style of, you know, Paris Hilton sitting around his butt on the pool, or sitting around the pool on his butt waiting for the dividend checks to arrive. So I think that's what this is.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more from Families USA Health Action 2012 here in Washington, D.C. at the Hyatt Hotel. We got a revolution. We got a revolution. And Dick Gregory is here with me at Health Action USA, Health Action 2012 Families USA. And we were just speculating about, you know, what's going on with this whole campaign thing.
Well, here's what's going on. I live in a white, racist, no respect for God. They think they have. That would rather see a Gingrich in, who cannot beat Obama,
yeah,
than have a Mormon in that might could.
You think that it's the religion thing?
Man, in America, with our viciousness towards, we would put a wild gorilla out the jungle in the White House before we put a Mormon in. That's why you don't hear anybody talking about it.
Well, and you know, one of the big phony hits on Obama when early on was Pastor Wright was not a good Christian because he was talking about, you know, black liberation theology,
yeah,
or things like that, you know, all this kind of stuff. And then, but that wasn't enough. Like, that didn't really grab people. So then they said, you know, he's a Muslim, did you know?
Yeah.
And that's, and what's amazing is more than 50% of the Republican electorate to this day thinks he's secretly a Muslim.
Yeah, but it don't make any difference because in America it ain't the folk that vote that count, it's the folk that count the vote.
Yeah.
I live in a country today that don't have one black senator.
Yeah.
So are you telling me it's easy to get a black man in the White House than it is to get one in the Senate? That's like it's easy for me with bad credit to buy a Rolls Royce than to buy a used Ford.
Yeah.
You know, something wrong.
Yeah.
And then the Occupy movement, what a blessing.
Yeah.
But it's not going to work.
Yeah, I just came back from the Supreme Court. We occupied the Supreme Court this morning.
But it's not going to work.
Why?
Because they really believe with white privilege that the country worked right one time.
Uh-huh.
And we wonder what it never worked right. And I keep telling them, go up and ask the Indians. Go ask the Indians.
And that's, and you're saying that because the Occupy movement is mostly white?
No, I'm saying that they really believe that America was a good country at one time, and we want to get back to that. When they asked me when they first put together, and I'm there with them, I think that's why the soldiers came home from Iraq, because they're gonna have to gun them down like they did Kent State. Okay. How do you been occupy a country for 8 years and bring the soldiers back in 2 months, but your $1 trillion of equipment, when is it coming back? Something ain't right about that.
Yeah.
And so they asked me, said, what can we do to learn from the black? I said, nothing. Come on, Greg, what do you mean? I said, well, to be born white in America, tall, short, rich, poor, educated, uneducated, you're born with 300 years of white privilege.
That's right.
Huh? So when we
three
came,
centuries of it.
Yeah, when we came.
4 centuries of it.
When we came to Washington, we said, poor people's campaign, that don't threaten nobody. They came with white privilege saying, taking back D.C. Oh, we'd have said that, we'd have died the first day.
Yeah.
They said, occupy Wall Street, occupy, that's when a powerful nation go and occupy a weak nation. See, the whole termination. So I'm sitting here at the demonstration, and I saw them harassing them, the cops harassing them. They had these big fat horses and dogs. And I asked a question when I was speaking to them. I said, When's the last time you cops carried a fat horse and stood in front of a whole house? It's illegal. Prostitution. When's the last time you had one of your dogs bite a pimp? When's the last time you pepper sprayed a mafia syndicate hoodlum? Going to together with the dope pushers to stand on the corner and see if they've ever been sprayed with pepper spray. It's a whole different, and then they use all kinds of, well, they won't be here when it gets cold. I said, can you white folk be that crazy?
You know,
let me tell you, they white folk created the $5 trillion industry called skiing.
Yeah.
The wintertime.
I had a friend in town here, African-American woman, who said, we were talking about the Occupy movement here, and she just came right out and said, she said, I would love to go down there. I would love to be part of that Occupy movement, but as a, and she's in medical school here.
Yeah.
And she said, I know your son is a chiropractor. And she knows him.
Yes.
And she said, you know, but as a black woman in America, she said, you know, these young white kids, they can get arrested and they'll still have a life. But as a black woman in America, if I have an arrest on my record, I'm not going to be able to finish that school. And if I do, I'm never going to get hired.
Yeah, well, that's the privilege.
That's what I'm talking about.
But when you're born with privilege, you don't know it until it's gone.
That's right. Yeah.
You don't know it until it's gone.
Yeah, and that's the thing that you did for me when I was a teenager, and I told you the story when we went to Africa together back in the 70s. This was back in 68, when I played your album, The Light Side, The Dark Side, all four sides, got me fired from that radio station. The only time I've ever been fired from a job. And it's like, and everybody should, you know, go out right now and find and buy some of the old Dick Gregory albums.
Yep.
I mean, The Light Side, The Dark Side, I think is the most brilliant you ever did. It's a two album set, and it tells white people the story of what it's like growing up black in this country.
Yes.
I grew up in the lower middle class, but it was a white neighborhood, and the black kids I knew were the ones who got bussed in, and it was you have done so much for me and for this country.
I got a minute to tell you something.
Yeah, we got 1 minute.
Okay, when you think about the hundreds, thousands of black cops in America, you've never picked up the paper or TV or radio, heard on the news, where over and over some white families crying. Or some black cop shot their loved one in the back of the head 40 times. Now, is that because black cops is more spiritual, better trained? No. We know that white folks ain't going to tolerate it.
Whereas black folks are getting shot by white cops and black cops, for that matter, all the
time. Yeah, well, the mentality is a mentality. But I tell you what a white cop ain't never done.
What's
that? Took his nightstick and hit my car.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Is that scary?
Yeah.
Hit my car and you in trouble.
Because that's property.
Yep.
That's property.
Hit my car and you are in trouble. That's what the movie and the play Ragtime and the book was about.
Yeah.
Did you see Ragtime?
I did not, no.
You should.
I will go looking for it.
Thank
Dick
you,
Gregory, one of our nation's treasures. I don't know how to describe it beyond that. You are.
I've been blessed. They say that about Jesus on Thursday. He was dead on Friday.
Well, let's hope that's not the case. God
never,
forbid.
Never.
Dick Gregory, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Much appreciated. We'll be back from Health Action 2012. Tom Hartman here.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman here with you. It's the third hour of our program, but it's Friday. And if it's Friday, it is Brunch with Bernie, although I had to go spend the first half hour here of the show. We had Carl Frisch filling in because I was over speaking in front of the Supreme Court. We were occupying the Supreme Court today with a permit. It went very well. It was a fine time was had by all. But I'm back, and Senator Sanders is with us. Sanders.Senate.gov is website. Bernie, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you. I'm by the way, if you hear weird background noises and whatnot, I'm here at this Health Action 2012 conference put on by Families USA at the Hyatt in downtown Washington, D.C. So what's happening with you and what's happening in the Senate?
I think
you've already mentioned one of the issues that's happening with me, and I think with the whole country, and that is we're about to celebrate the second anniversary of a very, very disastrous 5-4 Supreme Court decision on Citizens United. And I applaud you, Tom, and the others who are out in front of the Supreme Court today in protesting that decision and demanding that it be overturned. As you know, Congressman Ted Deutsch and I have introduced a constitutional amendment to do just that. We've got now well over 180,000 signatures or names on our petition for people who are interested in co-sponsoring that effort. And you could do that at sanders.senate.gov. And I think all over the country at the grassroots level, people are beginning to rise up. We're seeing cities and towns beginning to pass resolutions in the state of Vermont, my state. I think there will be language coming before the state Senate there urging the Congress to move forward in overturning Citizens United. So we're gaining some momentum. But this issue, Tom, is so important because it's not some kind of abstract concern about campaign finance reform. What it is about is that if you're concerned about the decline of the middle class and the increase in poverty and the growing gap between the rich and the poor, or the fact that we have 50 million people without any health insurance, and we're the only country in the industrialized world without a national health care program, if you're concerned about the fact that we're not addressing global warming and moving to sustainable energy and energy efficiency, if you're concerned about what goes on in foreign policy and our tendency to get into wars that we should not have gotten into, you must be concerned about Citizens United and campaign finance, because everything that happens on the floor of the Senate or on the House has everything to do with the huge amounts of money that's coming into the political process, and the fact that the House and the Senate end up paying a great deal of attention to the top 1% and often turn their backs on the middle class and working families. So we've got to get a handle on campaign finance reform. We've got to overturn Citizens United. In my view, we've got to move to public funding of elections. But this is a huge, huge issue that has got to be addressed.
Yeah, absolutely. And it seems like for the first time since maybe the 18-year-old vote or the end of Prohibition, people are waking up and they're taking seriously a discussion. David Cobb was telling me that that law school professors are starting to contact. He's with MoveToAmend.org. They contact him. That you've got. I mean, there's different factions and different groups and all, but it all kind of comes to the same thing, which is like your amendment as well. Is let's have a conversation about this. Let's work this out and let's push back against these five guys who think they run the country.
Well, here's what you got. I mean, what you have and what we are moving toward is a situation where today, in this election, we understand the media reports that folks like Karl Rove will be controlling over $200 million in campaign funds, which will be sent into any state they so choose, probably for negative ads, and without disclosure.
Right. And that's probably a minimum floor.
That's right. And then you got the Koch brothers, who I think are talking about spending even more. So you're talking, in all likelihood, about billions of dollars coming into the political process. And the impact of that is the following. What it means is that when senators and members of the House have got to vote on an issue, they're going to be thinking twice whether they want to stand up to Wall Street or insurance companies or drug companies, because they will know full well that when they go home a few days later, there could be huge amounts of money in ads attacking them. So they're going to think twice. It's going to make the Congress a much more conservative body, even more conservative than it is right now. The good guys are going to have to spend even more of their time raising money to try to counteract the influence of these super PACs. And you are going to essentially diminish to a very, very significant degree the ability of the ordinary person to have an impact over the political process. That's what we're dealing with here. So I see this as certainly one of the major issues of our time, and I would hope very much that people at every level get involved in this, because I believe it is not just a progressive issue. I think you talk to your average working-class Tea Party person and you ask them whether they think a handful of billionaires should control the political process, I think they're going to say no. I think moderates are going to say no. So I think we've got a good chance to turn this around, and certainly this is a discussion that must take place and must take place right now.
Yeah. Amen. Your thoughts on the healthcare system, and Medicare is under continuous assault, the Social Security and whatnot.
Well,
Broadcasting from this Health Action Conference, and we've been talking about that.
Okay, let me just say a few words on that. I think what happens in our world, you know, we have the Republican primaries, and everybody is talking about, you know, Romney and Gingrich and Santorum and so forth. But let us, I think those of us who are serious about the future of this country, get beyond personalities. And one of the things I will say about this Republican primary is the degree to which these guys are not talking about the major issues facing our country, including health care. And here's the health care issue. The health care issue, in a nutshell, is that we have 50 million people who have no health insurance at all today. We have 45,000 people who die every single year because they don't get to a doctor when they should. We have health care costs are soaring. They've slowed down lately. Because in the midst of a recession, people can't afford to go to the doctor. Mm. We are the only country in the industrialized world that does not provide health care as a right. And we say, hey, if you're rich, you can get the best health care in the world. But if you're working class, if you're poor, if you're middle class, well, and you don't have that deductible that you need to pay to get into the doctor's office, you don't have any health insurance, sorry. Sorry. Tough luck.
And Republican audiences applaud that, actually.
Pardon me?
And Republican audiences, you know, the Let Him Die, Ron Paul committee, you know, the Republican audiences applauded that notion that we should have this horrific health care system we have in this country.
Well, I think people have got to stand up and say it's time for the United States to do what every other major country has decided long ago. Mm-hmm. And that health care is a right, that if you're a working class person or you're rich, you know, this is a basic right.
Yeah.
People should not be forced to die because they don't get to a doctor or to suffer or to see a shortening of their lifespan. So, and on top of all of the rest, we end up spending for this bureaucratic, wasteful system almost twice as much as any other country on earth, and our healthcare outcomes often lag behind other countries in terms of longevity, in terms of prevention of various diseases or infant mortality. So, no question to my mind, we need a major overhaul of the healthcare system. At this moment, clearly, we've got to fight to prevent cuts to Medicare and Medicaid. But more importantly, we have to move toward a national healthcare program guaranteeing healthcare to all people. My state in Vermont, and I'm working with the governor on this, I hope we will lead the country forward into a single-payer system. And if we can do it well, I think a lot of other states will follow us and eventually the country. But what we call a Medicare for All single-payer program obviously is what we've got to be fighting for.
Right. And a good chance that that will come about in the next months or years in the state of Vermont with your leadership.
We certainly hope so.
And others. We're talking with Senator Bernie Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Move to our third hour today because I was down occupying the Supreme Court in our first hour. And fine time was had by all. And your calls for Senator Sanders up next. Stick around. 866-987-THOM.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
As I mentioned, 866-987-THOM, our telephone number, your calls, our national town hall meeting, and check out sanders.senate.gov to sign Bernie's constitutional amendment. Freedom is seldom found by beating someone to the ground, telling them how everything. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, live from the Health Action 2012 conference in Washington, D.C., put on by Families USA. It is our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls in our national town hall meeting. And Robert in Raven, Georgia, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Senator Sanders. Currently, it's my understanding that it is illegal for foreign citizens to contribute to political campaigns. Is this the case?
Yes.
Okay. Then is it also the case that a corporation that has been created by a foreign or an illegal citizen to contribute to the campaigns under Citizens United?
Rob, you've made an excellent point. One of the outrageous aspects of Citizens United is that at a time when there are many, many companies in the United States that are partially, significantly, or totally owned by foreign interests, these corporations can get involved in the American political process. So here you have foreign companies who have the capability now, under Citizens United, of putting ads on television. And what an outrage that is, that foreign companies now have a door wide open to them to influence American politics. One of the things that we have tried to do in terms of opposing Citizens United is that while we continue the fight and must succeed in a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United, there are some short-term pieces of legislation that can be passed which will ameliorate the damage. One of them is, in fact, to say, sorry, foreign corporations are not allowed to get involved in American politics. And that is certainly something that we should be doing.
Morty in Pasadena, California, listening to KTLK. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, Senator Sanders. Tom, good to talk to you. Senator Sanders, do you think it would be a good idea with all the Citizens United talk in the air right now that Harry Reid bring back up the Disclose Act, which only lost by one vote the last time the vote was taken, and just force the Republicans to vote for nondisclosure? Because the Supreme Court said, hey, you can bring sunshine to it. In fact, they encouraged you all to do that. You tried to get that through, and it failed. And wouldn't it be a good idea just to put them on record? And maybe you
Marty,
think what Scott Brown or somebody to vote for.
Let me just amplify what Marty is talking about. As I said just a moment ago, while the fight, the ultimate goal has got to be a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United, short-term there are some things that we can do to significantly diminish the damage done by that horrendous Supreme Court decision. One of the things that Marty is talking about is the Disclosure Act, which we did bring to the floor, lost by one vote, did not get one Republican on board. And what Disclosure says, among other things, is the following. As a candidate for the United States Senate, and I am a candidate, I'm running for re-election, if I were to put an ad on television in the state of Vermont, I would have to say that I take responsibility for this ad. This ad, take ownership of the ad. If we had a provision of legislation that said that when corporations put ads on television, the CEO of the corporation that is putting the money into that ad says, yes, I, the CEO of ExxonMobil or whatever, I take responsibility for this ad, I approve of this ad, that would go a long way, a long, long way, to make sure that these corporations are not putting ads on television or radio, because they do not want their name out there. They want to hide behind phony groups. So Marty's point is exactly right. There are some short-term actions that we can take to diminish the negative impacts of Citizens United. I would hope that some Republicans would join us, and that is exactly what we should be doing.
Denise in Wadena, Minnesota. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Thank you for taking my call. Senator Sanders, I'm very concerned about the National Defense Authorization Act, and not just the civil liberties it takes away from us, but the amount of money that's being spent. You know, the dogs of war are getting fat, and our children are starving. What's being done to fight against this?
Well, thank you very much for your question. You know, I voted against the National Defense Authorization Act. And I voted against it for two reasons. Number one, as you indicate, the civil liberties aspects, the possibility of indefinite detainment of American citizens. And that was obviously a good enough reason to vote against it. But very, very little attention was paid to the amount of money we continue to spend on defense. Now, the good news is that our troops are out of Iraq. Well, where is the peace dividend? Is there a peace dividend? Not really. Not really at all. We right now have a defense budget, which, as I recall, is about three times as much as it was in 1997. We are now spending, as I understand it, more money on defense than the rest of the world combined. So I think all of us want to make sure that the United States does have a strong defense posture, that we are able to protect our people. But as the caller indicates, when we have millions of people without any health insurance, when we have more and more people living in poverty, when our child care system is totally inadequate, we have so many needs in housing and education, the idea that we continue to spend so much money on the military is wrong. And the answer is, what do we do about it? Well, some of us are working very hard on that to come up with legislation and a proposal that, while making sure that we continue to have a strong military, make significant cuts in wasteful defense programs.
Yeah, I think Ron Paul the other night tried to make the distinction between defense and military that you're making, basically, that we can defend ourselves without having this, whatever.
But by the way, I would say, Tom, getting back to Citizens United and campaign financing, if you think the size of the military budget and all of these weapon systems are not related to the power of military-industrial complex, you would be wrong.
Ah, excellent point. Excellent point. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie, our national town hall meeting. Back with more of your calls for Bernie in just a minute.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And be sure to get over to sanders.senate.gov and put your name on Bernie's petition to amend the U.S. Constitution. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you live from the Health Action 2012 conference put on by Families USA. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, our national town hall meeting with Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. You're still with us, Bernie?
Yep, right here.
Okay, let's pick up a call here. Dave in Phoenix, Arizona. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Tom. Senator Sanders. Baby boomers are retiring at $300,000 a month. Where are these jobs going? Thanks for your answer.
Tom, I missed the first part of that question.
He said 300,000 baby boomers are retiring every month, and he's wondering why those jobs apparently aren't being picked up by somebody else.
All that I can say, Dave, I don't know the answer to that. I don't know if that, in fact, is an accurate number. But I do believe that the jobs crisis is the major issue facing our country right now. And the Congress has got to move very, very boldly in addressing that crisis. Because if we don't, the middle class will continue to decline. Real wages for people will continue to go down. Older workers will have a very difficult time finding jobs. Many of them are now working for a lot lower wages than they used to. So about all that I can say, Dave, is one of the things that has bothered me very much about this Republican primary is while they're busy attacking each other personally, I've heard very little discussion other than the usual trickle-down economics of giving tax breaks to the rich of how you address the need to create millions and millions of good-paying jobs. And I would just tell you that some of us believe that by investing heavily in our crumbling infrastructure of roads, bridges, rails, water systems, we can go a long way to create jobs. We also can create over a period of time millions of jobs, transforming our energy system away from fossil fuel and foreign oil into energy efficiency. We are wasting just a huge amount of energy all over this country in buildings where heat is just leaking right out the windows and the doors. And also into sustainable energy. If we can build our solar energy and wind energy and geothermal, create jobs doing that, and we begin to the process of reversing global warming. So I those are the actions I think we need to take, Dave.
Robert in Los Angeles, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello?
Hello, Robert, you're on the air.
Yes, I have 2 points. First off is the financial, because the RICO statutes, I think that would apply to the financial sector too, because of what's going on. And also, want to say about we need a national election policy in this country also. That is very, because from state to state, you know, it's so different with all these IDs and all sort of racist stuff that's going on. We need a national election policy and I hope, it's probably not going to happen this year, but if I hope Senator Sanders picks up the and sponsors a bill on this. Thank you.
Okay, well, I think what, thank you, Robin. I think what Robin is talking about is the RICO laws being applied to Wall Street. And in the midst of everything else that's going on, I hope that nobody for one moment forgets the fact that we're in the midst of this horrendous recession where so many people have lost their jobs, their homes, their retirement savings because of the illegal behavior, because of the recklessness of the major financial institutions in this country. And we can't lose sight of that for a moment. It's very easy to get distracted. That's the reality. We need real Wall Street reform. We need to arrest those people on Wall Street who have been involved in illegal activity that has caused so much harm. And that is, among many other issues, something my office is working on. We are going to come forward with some language soon in terms of reform of the Fed, real Fed reform. We've got to be talking about breaking up the large financial institutions. Tom, too few people fully understand that the six largest financial institutions in this country, top six, have assets equivalent to two-thirds of the GDP of the United States of America, about $9 trillion. Six financial institutions. And I think if Teddy Roosevelt were alive, he would be talking about breaking them up. And that is exactly what we have to do. And they control a significant part of the mortgages that are written, the credit cards that are processed. We need to break these babies up. So that's an issue. And in terms of election reform, Robert is right. What we're seeing right now in parts of this country is, to me, really, really outrageous. If this has nothing to do with political differences of opinion. This has to do with voter suppression. This has to do with right-wing Republicans who say, I guess we don't have the ideas to win an election. The way we're going to win an election is by denying people the right to vote who are poor, who may not own a car, who may not have a driver's license and the proper photo ID. I think that that is just disgraceful, that people have to force people off the voting rolls rather than try to convince them to vote for them. So I think we do need strong election reform laws. I've been working a little bit with the Attorney General's office on this. The President needs to speak out strongly on this, and the Attorney General's office needs to get more actively involved.
Agreed. Jerry in Terre Haute, Indiana, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, that's Kerry, Tom, but that's okay. I've always got a question in my mind when I hear about companies or people, and people or companies. How do we know as Americans that they're all qualified to vote?
That,
you know, are they hiding behind the word company and just put down as an electric?
Well, are you suggesting that corporations are voting, Jerry or Kerry?
Huh?
I'm confused.
Repeat that?
Yeah, I'm confused by your question. Are you suggesting that corporations are voting, or are you saying that it's the irony? Are you pointing out the irony that the court says that they're people, but they don't vote?
Well, all the people in that company, they all have to vote individually, don't they?
Yes.
Right, of course. Well,
Are they all qualified to vote, or are they just being put down as an electronic number as part of the company? Just how far do they go with that? Companies are people, you know.
Okay.
Well, let me be very clear, Jerry. I do not believe that corporations are people. I think the vast majority of the American people, regardless of political persuasion, do not believe that corporations are people, that they have First Amendment rights to spend as much money as they want without disclosure on political advertising. And that's the issue that we are working on. People who work for companies, like almost everybody in America works for a company, of course, they have the right to vote and participate in the political parties. But a corporation, which is an entity created by the government, is not itself as a corporation, as ExxonMobil or Bank of America, allowed to go into their, should not be allowed to go into their treasury and spend as much money as they want without disclosure on campaigns.
Margie in Portland, Oregon, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Senator. It's really nice to talk to you. My question is, I'm very political, and I noticed that there's a big lack of Democrats, actual liberal Democrats, particularly getting seen anywhere on TV or anywhere else, while all we see is, I mean, I don't know how many of these debates we have to watch, but we're always getting, like, one side of the story. So what can we do to get out the idea that it's not just the president? Our real problem is Congress. How do we fix the congressional sellout problem? You know, by feeding fixed information
to
people who don't get it.
And I thought where you were going with your first question had to do with the corporate control over the media. And I always get a big kick out of my conservative friends talk about the quote-unquote liberal media, when if you look at who owns the major television networks, and not just Fox, of course, you find them to be very large multinational corporations. And I'm not quite sure how anyone thinks that they are quote-unquote liberal. And if you listen to talk radio, Tom Hartman being one of the great exceptions, 90% of talk radio is dominated not only by right-wing people, but extreme right-wing people. And there are parts of this country where if you're just an ordinary person, you're a truck driver, just listen to the radio. The only thing you can get is extreme right-wing radio. So I think trying to create a more democratic media where people's different points of view can be heard is itself enormously important. The other part of your question, if I understood it correctly, is to make it clear that right now in the House of Representatives, that body is controlled by probably the most right-wing group of people that have ever controlled the body of Congress, certainly in the modern history of this country. And we have right-wing extremists in charge of the U.S. House of Representatives. You have some of these folks who, in their heart of hearts, believe not only want to cut or privatize Social Security and Medicare, some of them believe that those programs are unconstitutional. The federal government should not play a role in education. They would like to abolish the Environmental Protection Agency. Certainly very few of them believe that global warming is real or that the government should be actively involved in trying to save our planet, transform our energy system. And, yeah, that is an issue. And I think I would agree with you. I think that the media does not make that point anywhere near often enough.
Yeah. Or the problem of the filibuster being abused.
Yes.
Yeah, just the whole spectrum. Senator Bernie Sanders with us here on our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie. His website, sanders.senate.gov. If you're concerned about Citizens United, you can do something. Go over to sanders.senate.gov and sign Bernie's petition to amend the Constitution to reverse out Citizens United, this bizarre ruling from the Supreme Court.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit tomhartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more of your calls for Senator Sanders right after this.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them blue for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
That's my father's favorite song. We'll be back with Bernie in just a second, but every Friday in our third hour, we do our thank yous here. Just real quickly, thank you to our show director, Louise Hartman, to our executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producer, Jacob Dean, video director, Jim Javinsky, our phone screener, Julie Lulley, our screener researcher, Paul Edney, our writer researcher, Sam Sachs, and Andrew Campbell, to Alva Goldbook for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, to our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, all the folks at the various companies that syndicate our program, Dial Global commercially, Pacifica Radio non-commercially, Free Speech TV on Dish Network and DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Networks, and others around the country, to Dennis Chernoff, Don Rojas, and all the other great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to Rachel in Santa Fe, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, to the folks who work in our chat room, to Ellen Ratner and everybody at the Talk Radio News Service, Jay Goodman Tamboli for our tech support, and to our affiliates, our sponsors, and you for supporting our program. Thank you. Thank you very much. And now back to Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. And Joan in Atlantic City, New Jersey. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. Number one, I just want to say you're awesome, and we need a whole Congress full of people like you.
Thank you.
And number two, I wanted to ask you what your opinion is of what Stephen Colbert and Jon Stewart are doing with their Super PAC ads that they're putting on TV now in South Carolina.
I think that Stephen Colbert does a great job in making us and everybody else understand the absurdity of the so-called independent PACs, the Super PACs. And I think he does it in a very, very effective way. And I think working with Jon Stewart and Comedy Central, I think they are educating millions of people about the idea that the so-called independent super PACs are not independent at all. They are working hand in glove with the candidates. There are so many ways that you can do that. And exposing that is a very positive thing. So I think through their humor, they're playing a very important role.
Wayne in Jacksonville, Illinois. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, Senator. A few months back, I heard Tom mention on his show the Made in America law that's been neglected for 30 years.
Yep. 60 years. It was passed in 1935.
Well, okay, but it's been ignored since Reagan.
Yeah.
But at any rate, if I understand it correctly, it requires that the government buy only products made in America. And if that's the case, isn't that something that the Progressive Caucus and the labor lobby and sensible people in general should be making a lot of noise about now?
Wayne, you're absolutely right. The answer is yes. Some of us are, but I think we can and should be doing a lot more. If we want to understand why the middle class is declining and poverty is increasing and why we have lost millions of decent-paying jobs because corporations are outsourcing our jobs to China and Mexico and other low-wage countries, it is important to focus on how we rebuild our manufacturing sector in this country. I have been working in a couple of areas, but we've got to do a lot more. We've been working with the Smithsonian, who are in fact now going to be purchasing significantly more of their gift products made in the United States of America. We're working with the National Parks people, and they're also going to be purchasing more of their products made in America. Now, Tom, you may recall a few weeks ago, a veteran, a woman called us up, was in a VA hospital, and noticed that at the VA hospitals, many of the gifts and the supplies there were made in other countries. And we're now beginning to focus on that. But I think clearly the goal of, for at least the start, making sure that the huge purchasing power of the United States government, to as great a degree as possible, is focused on buying products made in the United States of America, is something that we should be doing.
Jack in Bellows Fall, Vermont, constituent of
Bernie. I was told, I didn't hear it on the news, that it was decided by a judge that the state of Vermont cannot close Yankee. Is that accurate?
That is accurate.
Okay, where is it going to go from here, Bernie?
Well, I would hope. I think the governor, and this is a Vermont issue, and what Jack is talking about is many of us in the state of Vermont wanted to shut down Vermont Yankee nuclear power plant in the southern part of the state, not very far away from Bellows Falls. And what a judge said, I think, in a very bad, poorly reasoned decision, that the state did not have the authority to do that, that the federal government had jurisdiction over the issue. The lawyers, Jack, are now studying the issue, and I would hope, and that's the governor's decision, not mine, but I would hope that we will appeal that to a higher court. I believe that for non-safety reasons, the people of the state of Vermont have a right to decide their energy future, which I believe should be energy efficiency and sustainable energy, and not nuclear power. So that's kind of where we are.
Bernie, we have a little less than a minute left to wrap it up. Your thoughts?
Well, sometimes, Tom, we look, and the calls are great, and they were great today, and we look at all of the enormous problems facing our country. I want to leave maybe with a note of optimism and point out to people that I think that in the last year or so, we've seen significant grassroots efforts to start transforming America. And let's not forget that our good friends in Wisconsin just recently, I think, was it a million? They've brought forth a million.
1.8 million.
1.8 million. Unbelievable, in order to do a recall of their governor, their right-wing governor. They have in Wisconsin already unseated through recall efforts two right-wing senators. In Ohio, the folks there, the unions and working families, fought back and won a tremendous victory in repealing anti-union legislation. I, from Citizens United, other activities, the SOPA business, I think you're seeing the reactivization of progressive grassroots efforts, and I think that's long overdue and something that we got to keep pushing.
Amen. Thank you, Bernie, for being with us.
Okay. Take care, Tom.
It is always an honor to have you on. We'll be back Monday. We'll see you then. And don't forget, democracy begins when you get out there and get active. Tag, you're it. See you Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.